This is Susan Williams in the MFA program in creative writing at Virginia Commonwealth University. It's Thursday, March 14th, 2002. I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I'm talking with George Garrett. In your book, The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You, one of the characters, Mo Katz, says, quote, "To be a cynic implies that there's some standard of truth, however camouflaged and hidden, against which the validity and viability of images must be tried and tested. To believe that there is anything, any core, behind and within the superficial appearance of a given image is de facto a confession of folly." Is this a way of saying that cynicism is at heart a sort of disappointed idealism?
That's on my mind. And about the time that I wrote that, this has just suddenly come to me in a way, because I haven't really thought about that particular passage in a while. But I do know that more than one speaker who came to the University of Virginia during the period that I was working on this book had the statement that there was too much cynicism in America today, and we must stamp it out, and this would be part of the educational process, et cetera. And I listened to this several times, and then I ended up on a panel with one of these people. It was a Washington Post guy, I think. Very nice fellow, but he started in on the necessity of fighting back against cynicism. Cynicism was the great enemy of all things. And I heard myself defending it. We didn't have enough cynicism. That what we needed was more, and a more acute sensitivity. And I guess I let some of that get into Mo Katz's defense of the cynical attitude toward things, that it does imply that things should be better if you're cynical about them. And it implies an acceptance of things as they are, I think, if you are not, if you feel that, as he said, that there is no core. So I think your question is a very good one, because it's an insoluble situation, but we have, if we did not have an ideal, there would be no such thing as something being cynical.
The question of whether there is a standard of truth, camouflaged and hidden, however it may be, seems to come up often in your writing. Would you say that this is an important issue for you? Would you say that you are, as a writer, a seeker after that standard, as some of your characters seem to be?
I have to look back at that. That's what interests me about characters, anyway, is their relationship to not only the inner truth of themselves, but the outward and visible truth of the world that they deal with. And that we live in an age in which much, in both areas, is truncated and suppressed. I've just been reading a book that's a bestseller right now. I'm sorry to say, it's a nonfiction book. I'm sorry to say it's not very terrifically good. It's not very well written, but the content is rather interesting. It's called Bias, by this fellow who worked for Bernard Goldberg, who worked for CBS News for quite a while, and then has sort of become cynical about it and written this. But it's quite clear to me, we are living in the information age. And we're exemplary of that is the very equipment that we're using right now, with that kind of really fancy little digital tape recorder and a microphone, all of these things. We are in the information age. But what if the information isn't any good? I've often wondered about that, just as I do of, let's use the computer and look up everything on cynicism. But what if they didn't put everything on there? We're used to the fact that our information comes to us in various forms, but if it comes from television, it comes in the sound bite. And that doesn't take us anywhere. If it takes more than, as all these people, Mr. Goldberg reminds us too, if it takes more than a minute, 1 minute, to deal with, it's too complicated for television anyway, so it's never going to be on there.
That was one of Jimmy Carter's problems.
Absolutely, I think. And he never did accept the notion, and for which we can be grateful, I think, but he never did accept the notion that the whole world was a series of sound bites and misquotations.
I wonder if it's getting worse now with the internet, because so often when you surf the web, you have no notion of the bona fides of what you find.
It seems to me a very hard way to find new information, because obviously anything that ends up, as it were, stored or on the computer and accessible has got to be old information that someone has typed in and put into the machines. What about the things that have, are not? That's what we're, you know, in the discovery of truth, we need to be finding what's not readily accessible and available, and what may be more complicated than requiring 1 minute.
Another question I had is that many of your narrators express a strong sense of irony or even sarcasm. And that's certainly true for the narrator of Empty Bed Blues. As a reader, I'm tempted to give slightly more credence to a clearly ironic or sarcastic narrator, maybe because he seems smarter than a naive narrator. And I just wondered how you see this sort of sarcasm working in your stories.
Maybe one of the first things to say is that sarcasm isn't necessarily what I meant. They frequently take a sarcastic stance vis-a-vis something. And I think what I'm really interested in is, and then maybe this comes to your point, is not just the point that a sarcastic narrator is not necessarily an unreliable narrator. Sarcasm is a rhetorical device. We know when other people are being sarcastic with us most of the time. It is usually considered in social intercourse and relations a sign of being slow of wit not to know when someone is being sarcastic with you. On the other hand, to be too sensitive to the sarcasm of others is to be paranoid. And yet, nevertheless, it's out there. But in no case is a sarcastic narrator or speaker in a social situation necessarily an untruthful one or an unreliable one.
I guess that's my question. If he's sarcastic, I recognize his sarcasm.
You trust the narrator more than you might. And I've been fascinated by this whole, just technically and in reading the work of other people a lot, to how narrators establish themselves as being worthwhile or worth listening to, and the extent to which they can, that we trust them and they have that, quote, reliability. Lots of people, we start with a first-person narrator. Now, this is not necessarily true in any other form, but when we do an I story, almost always as a reader, we're willing to give the narrator, that is, and also the author, that benefit of the doubt at the outset, just as when we meet somebody for the first time, we have a first impression, but we're not necessarily, unless we're a little crazy, completely judgmental at the outset. We withhold judgment and tend to give them, the first-person narrator, the benefit of the doubt. First-person narrator proves, then this comes up against experience. And may prove to be untrustworthy, unreliable, or just not capable of dealing with the experience. So it has to be, it gets tested. And we can change. But we're slow. You know, with first-person narrators, it always interested me that in the 19th century, ghost stories are mostly first-person. Because we believe it if somebody, an I narrator, says it. And anything that stretches credulity becomes probably more acceptable from a first-person narrator than the third-person narrator whom we see walking along perceiving this.
Some of your stories are collages.
It's just a stance that I've taken. I remember Walker Percy, a friend of mine belonged to Walker Percy's and the Percy's book club. They had a book club. And they would meet and discuss serious things. And on one occasion, my friend said, next week we're going to talk about one of the stories we're going to talk about. It's a story of yours. So great. Well, you know, let me know how it turned out. I've always liked Mr. Percy personally, but I never had viewed him or had any idea of what his attitude. Well, this was a story in which it's a very relatively simple one, but where you start with a truck driver at the wheel is the point of view, third person, and he has picked up a man who's hitchhiking, and he has to let him off, and the man doesn't want to get off, but he's not going in the right direction at this point. So you leave the truck driver wondering about this. He pushes, more or less pushes the man out of the truck and drives on. He's headed for Knoxville or somewhere. The man that was in the truck is left stamping up and down, being annoyed, and it's at night, waiting for another ride to come along. And you have just some sense of his, that you're in his consciousness. Then the third person is the salesman that picks the guy up an hour or so later and has a different take on the whole thing and ultimately drops him off in a town because he's too as nervous about it in a different way. And you're left with the final point of view, which also is a revelation of who he is and what he's been up to, of the man who had been the rider in both cases. This makes it sound, but basically it's like a baton in a race. They keep passing the point, this mm-hmm. point of view to each other. It's a little bit like movie mm-hmm. shooting. In other words, you stay with where the camera is. Camera is on the truck driver, the rider, the salesman, the rider, and then this is where it ends. Well, he said that they, in the course of the discussion about this, I mean, Percy pointed out that you are absolutely forbidden to do this. He said, oh, no, you can't. See, what's wrong with this story is you can't do that. You're not allowed to change from in third person from one point of view to another. And I realized, in a way, he's right, but my own thing was to try to get away with it. And it was really about how the story was, I suppose, now that we've been talking about these things, about how little you can know with a stranger that you pick up or vice versa. How little you can know of the truth of the other person. The reader always knows a little bit more than the people involved.
Did you choose the third person because of that?
I think I started out to write it all in the first person, but that sort of revealed the problems of the hitchhiker quicker than I intended mm-hmm. to do. And finally, that became the whole story for the reader to discern what had really happened and what was going on. Why this person was on the road, what was driving him. Now, I've just been watching something I've never done, really, a little bit, but just lately I've been reading in both fiction and nonfiction, which gets me kind of interesting because it's a fictional technique. Third-person point of view in which the point of view is not the author's, but it's not, it slips into something very close to first-person sort of in the middle of things. It'll start out with, it's a little bit like what Virginia Woolf does. Mm-hmm. There, that'll make a good, yeah. Where with Mrs. Dalloway, or where she's walking along and all of a sudden, it still is a narrator. Somebody is putting this story together, but we're, as if it, without ever saying, this is what she thought, we are, the very narrative is represents her mental process. And what was exciting to see this in nonfiction was people like, I've just been doing a piece on three prominent women writers who had collections of essays out, Joan Didion, Renata Adler, and Susan Sontag. And all three of them do this thing in the nonfiction. They'll be talking about Gordon Liddy or Nixon, or you know, they're all political essays or artistic things. In the case of Susan Sontag this time, but in almost every case, they don't really slip in like the fellow who did the biography of Reagan, pretend to be there or anything, but they do suddenly you're in the mental pattern as if that person were writing this, as if Gordon Liddy were writing the rest of this paragraph. And I had remembered having seen two writers in my lifetime that did this very well and sort of forgotten it in the interim. One was D.H. Lawrence, who did this. And understanding that makes his work a little easier to accept because it sounds like he's blowing his horn for all kinds of irrelevant to the storyline ideas, and he'll stop it. But actually, he's giving you the thought process of his characters in third person. Similarly, James Gould Cousins wrote about law, about the professions, about law and doctoring, and even the one about an Episcopal minister. And in every case, he uses the language and the thought process that they would use to tell the story. So he's picked it up as author.
It makes it problematic, I think, with nonfiction.
It does. It does, very much with nonfiction. Yeah.